Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. Good to have you all with us on this, cloudy, rainy, cold day and beautiful snow in the morning. And here we are here at WEAA with all of you. Before we start, get over to WEAA traffic, tell you what's going to happen. First hour, we're going to take a look at police and the community and the question of respect and disrespect and how police handle themselves. Can that change? And I was reading an article in the Afro last week called Cop Tunes, which is where police actually were taking pictures of people who they made it on the curb and then put them on Facebook. And one man who was a victim of that was mentioned in the article. He joins us this hour, Epi Chapman. We're also joined by Imam Earl El Amin and Doug Ward, and we'll jump into that conversation in a minute. And then in the next hour, we have a really interesting conversation and book. Barbara Ransby wrote the book Islanda, The Large and Unconventional Life of Mrs. Paul Robeson. People think Paul Robeson was this incredible character, which he was. Amazing human being. Multi-talented. His wife might have outshone him. Talk all about her in the second hour. Right now, we turn this over to WEA Traffic. Check on the roads. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. So, www.mecu.com, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. As I said at the top of the show, this conversation has happened for a lot of reasons. We've had it more than once, but I think it's an important conversation to continue having. Better to have with the police department in the room. There was this article written by Alexis Taylor in the Afro called Cop Tunes, raises questions for appropriate use of social media by Baltimore police. And you can go on Facebook and see it now as we're talking, Cop Tunes. It's on Facebook. Police take all manner of pictures, some just them in the community talking to people, getting a cup of coffee, doing their work, hanging out. But a lot of the pictures are people that have been arrested or people that are being just stopped in traffic stops and made to sit on the sidewalk, handcuffed, and having their pictures on put on this Facebook page. And when the article was written, one of the people they wrote the article about was a man named Epi Chapman, who is a heavy equipment operator, was pulled over by the police in January for driving with, I'll let him tell his own story, driving with a car with the front tag in the wrong place. What ensued from there was, and I'll let him explain it all, was something that happens a lot. The questions that we wanted to pose, we talked to Anthony Guglielmi from the police department. They couldn't supply anybody today. We're going to come back and do this conversation again with them in the room. We talked to the FOP, asked them to join us as well. But they couldn't provide anybody either. So we've been reaching out to the police departments to join this conversation. And the question we want to wrestle with is your own stories. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Is there an alternative way for the police to deal with the community rather than things that happen over and over again, especially to black men, especially to younger black men, but to everybody in general, with the kind of disrespect and humiliation and roughness? We have here in the studio with us Imam Earl El Amin, who's the resident imam at the Muslim Community Cultural Center of Baltimore. He's been a community activist for years. His father was one of the first black police officers in the force in the 1950s. So he's seen it from both sides. And Earl, good to have you in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
Always good
to
see you here. Doug Ward is with us. He's director of the Johns Hopkins University's Division of Public Safety Leadership that works with police officers across state and country, training to think of doing things in different ways. And Doug, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks. Always a pleasure.
A former major in the state police. Is that right?
That's correct.
That's right. And Epi Chapman is with us. Epi is the man I was just talking about, whose photo appeared in Cop Tunes on an unauthorized Facebook fan page where the city police officers post pictures of people they've arrested or stopped. And Epi, thanks for coming in. I really appreciate you coming in here.
Thanks for having me.
410-319-8888. Rather than read the article, would you just kick off the hour, tell your own story?
Yes, I was on my way home from work, and Baltimore City Police stopped me for not displaying my front tag. After he stopped me, I believe it was like three other policemen that was assisting him. One was one was African American cop. There were two Caucasian. I believe the other guy was a Latino. And when he stopped me, you know, the cop, he took my information and he was running my information. The African American guy, as he came on the scene, he looked inside of my car and he saw me moving around. He asked me, what was I doing? And I said, I'm just sitting here. He said, well, why are you moving around? I said, well, is it against the law for me to move around in my car? He said, no. He said, but what you looking for? I said, dude, this is my car. I can look for anything I want in my car. So he told me, put my hands on the steering wheel. Told me to stay there. Don't move. He said, I'm opening your car door. He opened my car door. And as he opened my car door, he said, step out of your car. As I stepped out of the car, he patted me down. He asked me if I had any weapons in my car, and I replied, no, sir, I don't have anything in my car. He said, well, can I search your car? I said, sure, you can search it. He told me to sit down on the curb, and the two of the officers that were on site stood on either side of me, and he searched my car. As he came back over to where I was, he pulls his phone out and he takes my picture. One of the officers asked him, what was he doing? He said, I'm taking his picture. He said, for what? He said, we have a website, on a link on Facebook called Cop Tunes. He asked him, what was it? He said, well, it's like a cartoon. We take pictures of people who we stop and we upload it on Facebook. And I said to him, I said, dude, you taking my picture to put it on Facebook? He said, yeah. I said, I don't think that's legal. He said, the law says that I can take your picture in a public place without your consent, and there's nothing that you can do about it. I said, well, I don't think that's true, and I don't believe it's legal. Furthermore, I don't appreciate you taking my picture and putting it on Facebook. And furthermore, you don't have my consent to put it on Facebook. He said, well, by law, I don't need it. He said, every chance that I get to buck the system, I'll buck the system. So I told him, I said, well, I guess we'll just have to see about it. So when I got home, I went to my computer and I pulled up Facebook and there was my picture.
And they, and in the process of this, they said because you didn't have your license was suspended, that that they towed your car away.
Yes, sir.
Rather than just saying,
yes, sir. I told the officer that I could call my wife and have my wife to come pick my car up. He asked me where I live. I told him I lived in Rosedale. He says that I'm not waiting for nobody to come and, you know, pick your car. I'm not waiting here all day. I said, well, I have an aunt that lives up the street. He said, well, who's going to drive the car after she comes down? I said, well, I can get somebody to come get it later. I said, it's parked right here on the street. He said, well, by law, we cannot leave the car here because if somebody break in the car and then they can trace it back to us and then we will be liable because somebody broke in your car.
So what's your first reaction, gentlemen?
I think it's incredible. I mean, obviously, we don't know the officer's viewpoint in this particular case, but if these facts are correct, I'm just astounded. I mean, it sounds like a harassment to me. I mean, I can't imagine. First of all, one tag car can be driven. I mean, you might give somebody a warning, tell them to go to the MVA and get another tag. To post a picture of someone in handcuffs, first of all, how do you get to the handcuff state? I mean, maybe it was a contempt of cop, as we call it, you know, where the police were irritated that maybe they didn't think he cooperated. But it seems to me like the police were looking for something to do, and maybe they had good intentions to start with. Maybe they thought it was some kind of drug case or whatever. But there's no excuse for this kind of thing. If these facts are true, there's just no flat-out excuse to post somebody's picture on Facebook, to handcuff them, to tow the car. None of it. Shouldn't have happened.
Now, let me make it clear. They did not handcuff me.
They just put your hands behind your back.
He just told me to sit on the curb.
So you had to sit on the curb?
Yes, sir. He never handcuffed me.
But you still weren't arrested?
Never arrested.
That's I think that's what we're saying. You weren't arrested. You just were asked to step out of the car and sit on the curb, but you weren't arrested. And he proceeded to take a picture of you.
Correct.
Before he ascertained the information about your status with your status with your license.
Correct.
It's interesting.
So the question this is kind of raised because there's so many things that have happened when you look at what's going on in New York and. They have the whole move to stop and frisk, where hundreds of thousands of young men have been arrested for small amounts of marijuana. They passed a marijuana law in New York a bunch of years back that said you cannot be arrested for having less than an ounce of marijuana. But also in that law, it said that if you display it, you can be stopped.
Right.
But even what you're not displaying, what's happened is many hundreds of thousands, literally, of young black men have been stopped and not just frisked and found reefer, but taken to jail. And so, all the studies show that there are more white people who smoke marijuana, more white young people smoke marijuana than young black people smoke marijuana in America by percentage and numbers, real numbers. But that 85% of the arrests in New York for walking down the street and having maybe a nickel bag in your pocket are black kids or Puerto Rican kids.
Kids of color.
Kids of color. And so there's that coupled with just the whole way – I had this conversation the other day with some people in the city one person in the city who I respect a great deal, and he runs a foundation in this town. And we were talking about that. We were talking about the Anthony Anderson case.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, isn't it true that, what happened was when Anthony Anderson was killed by a police officer when he was thrown to the ground and then his spleen erupted because his spleen was already damaged but was thrown to the ground. And I said, his spleen was damaged, but if he had never been picked up and thrown down, then in that instance, his spleen would never burst. And so are there other ways for us to treat our citizens? I mean, if here's a cop that's much bigger than he is, had him in a bear lock, the man couldn't move, there were three other cops around. I mean, there's other three police officers who couldn't come over, rifled through his pockets, found what they needed. If he had hair, whatever it was on him, gad that. And then put him in handcuffs, you were going to arrest him, take him away. Was it necessary to pick somebody up and throw them to the ground? I mean, the question is, can there be different ways for a police officer to show authority without it being disrespectful, humiliating, or violent? Is the question.
Mark, the question that you raise, absolutely. If in fact you have the proper training, first and foremost. Then you would proceed differently when you encounter someone if you're a police officer. I think beyond that, Mark, I think that the perceptions, and perception is a big thing, perceptions that are out there, especially about young men of color and how they're perceived, it's a very, very jaundiced view. And the other piece to this, Mark, is I think is very important. If you were to look at the number of recruits in the last maybe 5 to 8 years in Baltimore City, you probably would find that most of the recruits and those that have become police officers do not come from the Baltimore City metropolitan area, from areas like West Virginia, Pennsylvania. So we're talking about cultural – there's this cultural nuances that are going on here. With perception, and how to proceed when you encounter these young males of color, be they Latino or African American males, and so there's this dysfunctionality with the officer, and then there's this whole thing about power also that the officer has and doesn't understand also.
Doug, go ahead. I'll wait.
Well, I guess, people first, and rightfully so, want to focus on training, but I think it could go beyond that, and I think you touched on this. But what kind of people do you want to recruit to be police mm-hmm. officers is a big question, right? So if you're interested in crime control and retrospective investigation, there's a certain personality that may fit with that, and that's kind of the old school, lock them up. But if you really want to prevent crime and work with the community, you're going to want people with a different perspective. And I totally agree that the best way is to encourage people who live in a community to police that community. I mean, it's the when you have a stake, when you're an officer and you have a stake in the community in which you live, and you're coaching basketball and you're, you know, softball, and you're involved and live in the community and you care about it, it tends to work much better. Now, that's a difficult thing to do, I know, and it won't happen overnight. But that's one place to look. Who are we recruiting? What kind of policing do we want them to do? Do we want them to police with the community, or, as I call it, police to the community? So if you don't really care about the community and you have in your head that every person is a suspect, then you tend to get – you tend to find that for which you're looking.
Are we going to say something, Epi?
Yeah. You know, I really believe that as far as their training is concerned, that – it should be a thin line, you know, of what they can and what they cannot do, what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, and to the point where it's clearly understood by the officer and yet by the community of what a police can and cannot do. A lot of them, you know, claim to know the law, but really they really don't know the law.
Hmm. If I may, too, I mean, one of the things that happens is it depends on – we've all had these, you know, tests where we all see a same video, we see something different.
Mm-hmm.
It can be the same thing. So if you're a police officer and you're used to looking for drug suspects, every car at night becomes a drug suspect, a potential drug suspect, instead of a person coming home from work. That's a bad place to start, right, that everyone is a suspect. And so – you say you moved around in your car, and you have that right to do that. So a police officer can frame that and say, yeah, that's a furtive gesture. You may have been hiding drugs or reaching for a gun. And, you know, so it can all be framed differently depending on what you're looking for, right? You might be looking for your registration card. But if a police officer automatically is thinking, oh, this is a drug dealer, well, he's looking for a gun. In reality, not. So it's a mindset, too, involved here.
And that's why I said perception when I opened up, the whole perception and the whole notion. And when you go back, when we go back to this whole training issue that you talked about, or the lack thereof when we talk about training, it's very important to understand. I think that you hit an excellent point when you talked about, do you have a stake in the neighborhoods which you work in? In the environment which you work in, that's very, very important. I go back to my father when he was an officer. He also was a Little League baseball coach, first African-American team to win in 1968, I think, to win the state championship in Little League baseball. So there was a vested interest. And many of those police officers, Officer Fury Cousins, and many of them were Little League coaches. They worked in – so like you said, they were invested in the community. But after your shift and you leave and you get in your car and you go up 83 and you go back across the Pennsylvania state line, and that's where you reside, then you really don't have an interest in the community. So therefore, it's purely a job. It's purely a job. And so that in itself has a profound impact on the people that you're supposed to police.
Well, I have a couple questions about what all three of you have raised. Well, let me open the phones first at 410-319-8888. Keith, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Mark. First of all, what the gentleman said about the moving around the car, as much as your guest thought he might have been a cop, so he had the right to move around, everything like that. I mean, if an officer doesn't know who that person is, he doesn't have no right to be moving around. He doesn't be still and follow the officer's suggestions. And on top of that, it's something that just kills me in this city here. If you know your license is suspended, and everybody can say, well, I never knew. You know if your license is suspended, you shouldn't be driving a car in the first place. Now, as far as the Facebook pictures and everything like that, those officers are dead wrong and should be disciplined for that. But when you're making a traffic stop as an officer, you know, your life's in danger also. So, like I said, besides the pictures being taken, everything else was above board. That's my comment.
Thank you, Keith.
I wonder if he's a police officer.
Do you didn't identify himself as citizen? I'm not sure.
I don't know. I can tell you I've stopped thousands of cars over 27 years, and you can always be polite, and you can always stand up for a theory of justice, that justice should be served. And so it can be done. I've seen it done. I've seen it done by a lot of troopers and officers throughout. So, you know, there's a right way to do it, and there's a wrong way to do it.
Well, let me just ask this question before we go back to our next.
But before you go, Mark, yeah. I think I'd like to get back to what the caller, Keith, said. Years ago, they implemented a course with young males. It was called the Street Law Course. And there were certain things, do's and don'ts. I think David Miller and some other group, they also did a piece around that, what you should do if you are accosted by the police, to remain still, all of those things. So there might be some merit in what Keith is saying, that the street law was designed to help you not to don't move in the car, or don't move when you're talking to the officer. Look him straight in the eye when you speak to him. All those types of things, certain postures that you're taught in the street law course, how to respond.
It doesn't help that this officer was standing right beside my car at the time. So clearly he could see exactly what I was doing, you know. But and the same, a lot of times, you know, I believe that police allow their emotions to get the best of them. And back to the training, a part of their training, you know, should have the, I would say, a fighter's mentality. You know, a fighter, when he's taught that, you know, when he's in the ring and he's getting hit and getting pounded on, he's not to become emotional. He's not to think off of his emotions, but more so reflexes and his actions. And so, you know, you have to keep your emotions under control.
That's a conditioning. It's a conditioning. I think over time, that's a conditioning that they should have, you know.
So I mean, I wonder when you just from the perspective of a policeman, an officer, I mean, when you approach a car, I mean, you don't know what's going on inside that car.
Well, of course you don't, and you're trained, and you're ready for whatever may be occurring, right? So definitely. So you're filing car, and now you put the lights on, and you see somebody moving around in the car underneath the seat and so forth. Well, that's something to be wary of. That's not usually what happens. But also in the back of your mind, you're like, it could be a gun, or there could be hiding drugs or contraband, or they could be fumbling around trying to find their registration card. So you can't just discount that it might still be the registration card. And you're ready to do what you got to do. When you go up there, you approach the car a certain way, you can look into the car, and you have time to take action if you need. You can pull your gun out and use it if you have to. But once you determine that it's not a dangerous situation at that immediate time, you know, you kind of de-escalate and have a polite conversation. So, yes, you're right. Anything can happen, but it's very rare. You have to be prepared, but 99.8% of the time, it's not a bad guy with a gun when you go up to the car.
Let's get another call in on the way to break here at 410-319-8888. Stacy, you're on the air. Hi, Stacy, you're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
I just wanted to say, and I appreciate both of the callers and all of their input today, but I don't think anyone's really touched on the magnitude of the issue. I live in the inner city, and I see it every day. I see it so much that I almost want to videotape it or put it on Facebook myself, because it's like everybody is so used to it that nobody really complains about it, and everybody's so happy when they don't go to jail that they're like, they don't complain about it. Everyone's afraid. No one has a search warrant. No one has a warrant for a car. No one has a warrant to search a person's person. But that's what's done in the name of justice or crime prevention every day in my neighborhood. I think it's a matter of what your guest was saying about the officers not being able to relate to the people that they're policing. It's like a us-them mentality. So everyone's automatically a criminal. It's almost like they're criminalizing poverty which isn't right. So we live in a society, how sad is it, where we have to have a street law, where we have to teach young people how to act so they're not attacked or abused or treated improperly by someone who is supposed to protect them. It's just really sick. So I wish we could really get into the real issue of it, and I wish there could be a comprehensive training program that will allow the officers to really get to know the community they're policing so they don't automatically think they're criminals. They do have a vested interest. But I thank you for taking my comment.
Thank you mm-hmm. so much. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. And we pick up on what you said. Muhammad is on the line. Brian and Anita's on the line, and Neil Franklin's on the line as well, who and we'll bring him on the air. I didn't know he was in town. 410-319-8888. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the University of Maryland Transplant Program. Nearly 2,000 Marylanders are waiting for an organ transplant. The University of Maryland conducts research and performs procedures designed to optimize transplant rates and provide least invasive surgeries for organ donors. More information about the University of Maryland's transplant program and becoming an organ donor is available online at umm.edu/transplant. We are joined here in the studio by Imam Earl Al-Amin, the resident imam at the Muslim Community Cultural Center of Baltimore. Doug Ward, a 26-year veteran, do I remember that? 27 years veteran of the Maryland State Police, retired major, who is now director of the Johns Hopkins University's Division of Public Safety Leadership. And Epi Chapman is with us, who is a Baltimore citizen whose photo appeared on cop tunes and an unauthorized Facebook page where Baltimore police officers post pictures of people they stopped and also those that they have arrested. His story was in the front page of the Afro in the last issue, and this is where we met him. I wanted to bring this up. That was in the Indy Reader. Bonnie Lane, who's one of the homeless activists in town, asked the police about this policy, and their response in her article was, "The social media policy for officers is being developed. I don't know who authored this page. It's not authorized by the BCPD, the Baltimore City Police Department. I haven't received any complaints on this yet." That was the comment from the city police. I was looking for that, and one of the producers just sent it over. Number is 410-319-8888. Ask right to the phones, and then we'll bring up some other issues here. Muhammad, you're on the air.
Okay. From the neck up, check up. Do we remember the child that got killed down there in Poe Home? The police took him around the corner, put him on his hands and knees, and blew the back of his head out. I want to know, was that drug-related, that he knew too much in the community and the police was part of the conspiracy? Then again, I got a nephew who is a police. I'm not giving you who he is. Now, how many women have been stopped and gave a deal? You either go along with my proposition of dismissing this ticket if you have sex with me. So it's a lot of scheming and jiving with the police force, but I love them to death. You understand me? They got a job to do. But I'm in fear of all police, although my nephew is a police. You see, because I know the deal that can go down. Jackie Powell was the head of the Black Panthers. He stopped working. He threw his badge in because he seen something go down for no folks, killed the guy for no reason. Y'all have a good day. Check it out.
Thank you, Muhammad. I don't know anything about the Poe Home thing. It doesn't. But I also have a nephew who's a police officer in another state. And, I remember writing him. I said, we talk about these things all the time. And I said to him, I just want you to end up being a police officer who does it right and stays on the right course. But let me ask this question. We're talking about the – before you go back to the phones here. When Frazier was commissioner of the Baltimore City Police, he started PAL and was vastly ridiculed for starting PAL. And then it was ended after his tenure as commissioner. But there were a lot of people who thought that did a great deal of good. I mean, the idea that these weren't just – African-American officers who or folks who live in Baltimore City who were working in PAL was all the officers, whether they lived in the suburbs or they lived in the city or they lived in Pennsylvania. But people were involved. I mean, that project I thought was important.
Well, I think there's pros and cons with that. One of the things that I call it skill and will. The officers that were assigned in the recreation centers, because PAL took over a lot of the recreation centers, were not did not have they might have had the desire to work with the children, but they didn't have the skill. As someone who was a health and physical education major, and also recreation, then that there's some skill sets that you have to have when you in my observance of that, I saw that they just threw the ball out. There wasn't organized activities at a level where someone that was trained in recreation could provide. So I think that the idea was good, but I don't think that the people that were implementing the service that was supposed to be provided, I don't think that they were as good as they could have been. You see, they were police officers, and that not to say that, but they weren't trained in the capacity in which what the job that they were providing.
Yes, I think the intentions were very good, right? If you remember back in those days, it was with the start of the community policing wave across the nation, and there is no magic one program that's going to change everything. But that kind of thinking is very important because it's a preventive way of thinking, right? And that's, I think, what we need to somehow incorporate into a lot of different areas. How can we do a better job of preventing the problems? Because it's much cheaper. And it's going to, you know, it's the only way to get the city out of this vicious cycle, right? So we talk about gangs and things like that. Well, I've been hearing about that forever. Why do we have youth gangs, you know? Well, because more youth are joining them. So we're not doing a very good job of preventing these kinds of things. So maybe PAL's not the answer, the end-all, be-all, but it's a piece of the puzzle. You know, how do you get to kids earlier, get them a positive role model, get them off the streets and into something that's not out having time to get in trouble? Those are all important components. And I think that and I know Tom Frazier, and I know his heart was in the right place, and I know he tried, but you've got a subculture that you have to change, and it takes years. You know, some of these things take decades, but you have to keep at it. And, of course, in policing, it's very fad-oriented, so it became soft on crime. Well, we've got to go out there, and we've got to lock everybody up. Well, that's not going to fix it. You can't just keep building prisons.
Well, go ahead, Effie, then we'll go back to the phones.
One of the problems I see in the community growing up in Baltimore City is that the biggest problem I see is that you have a lot of kids raising kids. And so I believe it has to start in-house, at home. It has to start at home. You know, parents have to, you know, take the responsibility of training their children and raising their children and doing the best that they can, which is basically, you know, all that we can do. We have to find some type of way to stop kids from raising kids, because a child cannot teach another child how to be an adult when they haven't learned how to be an adult themselves.
Hmm. That is clearly an issue that we tackle a lot here. There's little argument about that, I think.
Yeah. You're going to the line, right? I guess we can go to the lines.
We're getting a couple people on once here. Anita Dukes, welcome to the show. And then I also want to bring Neil Franklin up. Neil? Anita, welcome. Did we just lose Anita?
I'm here, yeah.
Neil, welcome. Good to have you with us. Are you in town?
No, I'm still down in Florida.
Okay.
I love your show, Mark.
So Neil, describe what your job was. You're a former executive director.
I'm currently the executive director of a nonprofit organization that's trying to pretty much end the drug war. Law enforcement professionals.
LEAP, that's what it was. Law enforcement Officers Against Prohibition.
Right. And I'm down here on a 2-week tour in Florida, so that's why I'm not up there with you guys. But I just wanted to make just a couple of real quick comments, and I'll take it right from there. Mark, you know the drug war has pretty much created this adversarial relationship, this us versus them environment within our communities like Baltimore between the police and citizens. And, you know, even some of the officers who live in Baltimore, they have issues. They have problems also with respecting the citizens that they police in the city. It's more of a policing culture. The training that we give in the Baltimore Police Department, the laws, the skills, culture, sensitivity training, procedure, even the Constitution, it's all appropriate and it's all correct. The problem is when they hit the streets, when the officers hit the streets and have to deal with the culture of police there. Is the young man with the suspended license? Yeah, it's a maneuvering around in the car or what have you. But as Doug Ward said, there's a way to deal with that respectfully. And I doubted if that would have happened if it were a white gentleman being stopped at same age as the gentleman you have there. I don't think it would have gone down the same way. Again, if he owns the car, he has a right to leave it there legally parked. It doesn't have to be towed. It's his responsibility as the owner of the car. The major problem that we're having in the city with our policing issues is the lack of proper first line and second line supervision. They have a hands-off management style, and that needs to change.
But Neil, let me just—you raised the issue. I was going one of the two issues I was going to raise, and that's the question when we talk about officers have to be from a community, live in a community.
I'm
going to finish with it. So the question is that Doug really? I mean, it seems to me more complex than that, because I mean, you look at Prince George's County Police that has one of the worst records of police abuse of any department in the country, clearly in the state of Maryland, and almost half the officers are African American who live in and come mm-hmm. from Prince George's County. So, I mean, but there's something in the culture.
Absolutely. The subculture, if the subculture is bad, it doesn't matter where the officers come from, right? But in the best case, if you have a culture of justice, we're going to administer justice. It's a bigger thing than just arrest people. And if you have the right outlook there, we're going to uphold the Constitution, which we all take an oath to, by the way, and then some seem to forget that. But if that's the case, then it's much better to have people who are invested more in the community. I'm not saying you can't be from outside and still care very much. And it happens a lot all over the country. Not everyone lives in the city. I'm just saying it. For Baltimore, I think it would help. I don't think it's the total answer. But you have to – and I agree with Neil on this. The first and second line supervisors are key. They're the enforcers of the policies with the officers. And if they're not doing their jobs – it's out of control.
What do you mean by a culture of justice? What does that mean?
That means when you look at an individual, you look at them as having constitutional rights mm-hmm. that we all say we have, right? But in some places, at some times, and in some skin colors, it doesn't apply. It's not – so your job as a police officer is not just to enforce the law. It's to provide that person, whomever they are, whatever their status in life, with justice that they're afforded by the Constitution. It's a much bigger obligation you have then I'm just going to try and get the drugs or I'm just going to try and get the gun. You have to protect their rights as well. It's not just to make a statistic. You know, you know that I should or shouldn't search a car. You may say in your mind, oh, yeah, I know they've got a trunk full of marijuana, let's say. But if the Constitution protects that, you don't go over that line. You provide justice, even when it's distasteful.
And let me say something about what Doug just said. There's a big issue. There's a big problem with that in Baltimore City right now, and many cities like New York, as you know, Mark.
Right.
But there's a huge issue right there in our hometown of Baltimore City. Officers are violating the Fourth Amendment rights of those citizens left and right, whether it's strip searching some of these young boys in the street or whether it's stopping a car and pulling someone out of the car and searching that car. And you know, personally, I'll never give up my right regarding my protection from unreasonable search and seizure of my person or my car. I'll never give it up.
Were you about to say something, Earl?
No, I was just going to – I agree 100%. I think that – but the thing is that he just said something that's key. He would never give up his right. But when you don't know your rights, then you become a victim. And that's what happens. Most of these victims are young boys of color who don't really know their rights. And so what happens is the officer – justice does not prevail. It doesn't prevail with the young man because he doesn't have a working knowledge of what his rights are. So the officers cross the line. In many instances, they cross the line.
I mean, I think that
like they did with Epi.
Right. Way across the line.
My question
Mark,
is this.
What'd you say, Neil?
Yeah, I'm going to hop off real quick. All right. And I'm going to make one closing statement because I got a little bit of things to do here. I just want to comment real quick on the Facebook part. You know, the commissioner needs to address that. It's inappropriate, extremely disrespectful to the citizens of Baltimore to allow that to go on. The commissioner has also heard from me, and he knows about the first-line supervision issue in that department. I've told him what's going on there, and they've got a management leadership problem, and he needs to deal with it. So it's on his plate now. But thanks for having me on just for a few seconds, Mark. I'm still going to listen as I continue to move on to my other event here.
Thank you, Neil. Thank you. You were about to say, Effie, then we'll go back to the phones.
My question, in essence, to what you said was, as far as the young people, you know, especially young African-American people knowing their constitutional rights, how many of Baltimore City police know about our constitutional rights?
Well, it goes back to what Doug said about training, the training that they're trained with the constitutional rights. So it goes back to that in their training. I think that sometimes they just cross the line. I think that they know, like he said, there's certain aspects of the training that is good. And so, like Neil said, but they just cross the line.
So I believe that knowing and understanding is two different things. You know, it's like knowing how to drive a car. Just because you know how to drive a car doesn't really mean that you understand the process of driving, how to avoid accidents or how to avoid from, you know, hitting people and keeping pedestrians safe.
So in Maryland, for instance, the Maryland Police and Correctional Training Commissions have standards, and all police officers who are certified in this state go through a certain amount of training, a certain level of training, including the Constitution and including the laws. So it's hard to believe that the police at least haven't been exposed and were competent enough to pass a test on what the Constitution provides. So the subculture becomes whether or not it's supported out there in practice, right? And what the common practice and the what are the tolerances that the sergeant allows? And that's the key to this, right? So it's not just training. And every police – and I want to add, too – I don't want to seem like we're indicting all police officers, because mm-hmm. the overwhelming majority of police officers out there want to help people. They do a good job every day. They risk their lives for us, and we should be very thankful for that. But there's some that maybe just shouldn't be police officers.
But yeah, I want to get back to something Neil said.
I do want to get back to the phone. There's a lot of people calling in. Oh. Let me just get another caller in here. Okay. Come right back, girl. 410-319-8888. Brian, you're on the air.
Good evening. How are you doing?
Very well. Welcome.
When I read this article in the paper on Friday,
mm-hmm.
I was appalled, and I was particularly appalled by the response of Guglielmi.
Yeah,
I'm not quite sure how to pronounce his name. As speaking on behalf of the police, he seemed as if he was defending the police officers for this type of behavior. And that he was that there was that, and I guess it goes to this whole idea of this culture of a lack of really serving the community, but occupying the community that seems to have penetrated the Baltimore City Police Department, and because that's what that whole site is about. It's about how we keep these folks under control, and the mistreatment, the way in which people are portrayed and made to feel humiliated and dehumanized is ridiculous. And for the police department not to come out and make a strong statement of saying we are opposed to this type of behavior, that we do not condone it in any kind of way, is really disappointing. And as far as policy goes, they're talking about reexamining the policy and seeing if any policies have been violated, but we have to protect the First Amendment rights of the police officers. Well, that's all well and good, but the whole idea of serving the community is much more important, and I think our police officers must be held to a much higher standard. They're supposed to be defending and protecting the community. So I just find it very, very disheartening that the police department did not come out very strongly against this kind of behavior and made it very clear that it's not accepted or condoned. So with that, the other piece is, as far as changing the culture, what has to happen to change is that police officers who do not hold that position have to speak up. They have to be the voice of opposition. and they have to be out there, and they have to confront their coworkers, and they have to tell them, and they have to be bold, and they have to state very clearly that this is not the kind of policing that we need to be doing or should be doing.
The last thing you said, Brian, that's very tough to do. I mean, they stand up in the face of the people around, not saying they shouldn't be done.
It's an old fraternity. And you sometimes you don't cross the line. That's an old, you know, I think things are changing. Some people have come out, you know. We're not in the era of Serpico, I don't think. But I think it goes back to what Doug said and what Neil said. First and second line supervision. These are the people that are the supervisors. And when that level of that mid-level management of supervision is not working, then the department doesn't work. It's dysfunctional. Your sergeants, your captains. Is that correct, Doug? When we say that level of management, sergeants, lieutenants, that first and second line.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, that's where the rubber meets the road with you know, policy and how it's administered. But the other thing is too that lost my train of thought here for a second.
Well, I mean, my fault. The one thing that I think that I want to get back to and then try to get back to the phones here is how does it change? I mean, that's the things we want to get, which is why we wanted to get the police department and training people and the FOP folks on a show and a larger roundtable. The question is how do you get to that? Because it is the culture. And again, with all due respect, you know, I grew up with police. I have a nephew who's a cop. This is not anti-police. It is a question of how that changes. You can have – if you say it turns over to the captains and lieutenants, well, if they're from the same culture, that perpetuates it. How do you change a culture that deep?
Well, it takes a number of things, but one of the main things is it starts from the top, and that's where I see a large amount of hope here with Commissioner Batts. I mean, I've spoken to him a couple of times about things. I think he's our best hope right now to make the change, but he's got to have people around him that get it. They've got to have people who enforce it through up and down the chain of command. You know, we talked about who do you hire. You got to hire the right people. You got to train the right people the right way. You got to enforce the first and second line supervision of those people throughout their careers. It takes a lot of time, and this poor guy is coming into something that's going to take years, and he's got all kinds of problems crawling out from underneath all kinds of rocks. I think we need to wish him well. I know he gets it. I mean, this guy is really brilliant, and he gets it. He knows what to do, but he needs all of our help. And, you know, I think if people will support him, and we've got a shot.
I met with this gentleman, I could say Commissioner Batts, on three separate occasions, and I think he gets it. I really believe that he gets it. And like Doug said, but you know, those people around him, that can they enforce the things that these policies and uphold these policies that needed to be upheld? So it takes time. I think we live in a society that is a society that is immediate gratification all the time, and we're looking for this to him to come in and the police force to change in 6 months. It's going to take some time for this, and rooting out corruption. All of those things, because that's the perception of the community, in the neighborhoods, that they're crooked cops and so forth and so on. They just had one guy. A lot of these cases might be thrown out because this guy just got, I think, 20 years for. So this guy inherited a lot of things. So he's got to root that stuff out, and it's going to take time. And the community has to come to the forefront now. I think one of the things that we're doing a lot of indictment of the police department, but there has to be an accountability level from neighborhoods. Neighborhoods have to hold the police department as well as those in the community, because we have a saying: our community, our responsibility. So the community has to buy in on this too. You see, you just can't say, because let's be honest, if in fact the police weren't coming to work today and they just stopped, many of these neighborhoods would be anarchy. Let's be real honest. So we just can't indict the police department overall. There has to be a buy-in with the neighborhoods, the neighborhood leadership. There has to be a buy-in with that, and hold our parents and our children accountable also.
410-319-8888. One quick call. Let's see. Steve, you're on the air. Very quick thought.
Yeah, my comment. You guys talk about policy, policy, policy. It's not the policy. It's the whole entire city of Baltimore. If you guys don't come together as one unit, you know, you're going to have crime. You know, you're going to have a problem like the guy, you know, when the officer told him to sit still in his car. And, you know, they took him out of his car and set him on the side of the curb. You know, and then you're going to have the three victims just last week, the two young ladies and the guy, you know, in the apartment getting shot and killed. You know, you have to come together, you know, on the same page. And if you're not on the same page, then, you know, there is no hope. But you try to put some hope somewhere, you know, by teaching these kids. But it starts at home. And if mom and dad, you know, not at home doing their job, they come to these streets out here. And then when you lock them up, and then there's a problem, you know. And then we have this show like we're having now, you know.
I hear you, and I think as one of our guests also said, that there is a lot to do with the home. And I think that you can't. It's more than the home, though. I mean, the home is part of it, but it's a much larger picture than just the home. Do we have time for one more call? Yes, no. Pamela, you're on the air.
Yeah. Good evening. I love your show. I love your show. And
thank
there's
you.
So much good information going on your show right now. As I shared before, I just don't believe that we're holding our police officers at a high enough standard. Once upon a time, it was very admirable to be a police officer. We trusted our police officers. And now, I mean, we got our police officers showing up with, I mean, and forgive me for saying this, a lot of there's mouth jewelry going on. The police officers are always on the cell phone. I see police officers in my neighborhood, and I'm wondering, are you on the job, or are you socializing? And we don't want to group all the good with the bad. We know there are some great officers out there, and they have their heart in it, and they're looking after the people. But there's a lot of bad officers, and I just believe that we're not holding our police officers at a high enough standard. They're not showing up as professional people that we have expected them to be. If a police officer shows up to your home, you're wondering, who do we call to check him or her out to make sure that they're legit?
Well, Pamela, I'm sorry, we just ran out of time. You had some really valuable things to say. We stay on the subject. We're going to come back to it. We're going to invite all of our guests here back, along with the police departments, to continue this conversation in our community. I want to thank Doug Ward once again, Director of Johns Hopkins Division for Public Safety Leadership, for being here in the studio. Always a pleasure to have you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
For being so open to come out with us. Imam Earl Al-Amin, the Imam at the Muslim Community Cultural Center of Baltimore. Always good
thank
to see you,
Mark. Always a pleasure.
Epi Chapman with us, who came to the show, who is the centerpiece of the article written in the Afro about how he was mistreated, really, by the Baltimore City Police and what happened to him, his face being put on CopTunes, which is still up, and they hope that they take that site down off of Facebook. And I want to thank you all for being here. Before we do go off, we couldn't do this today, but we'll be doing it in the coming week to remember the great Chinua Achebe, who died at 82.
Right.
Things Fall Apart, his trilogy, his work, one of the great authors of our life, who just taught so many people, as an incredible human being. Passed away, and I was lucky enough to study with him for a semester. And we will come back to talk about him, if not later this week, then early next week, to remember Chinua Achebe, who passed away at 82 just on Friday. And stay tuned now. We're going to pick up a conversation with Barbara Ransby, who wrote the book Aslanda, The Large and Unconventional Life of Mrs. Paul Robeson. Stay with us.